Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdoctoral fellows are working on. Today, I would like to introduce you to Kanna Ogawa, who recently completed her master's in the Department of Translational Medicine under the supervision of Drs. Teresa and Jamie Persner. Welcome to GradChat, Kanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for coming in today, especially after you've just defended and been so busy. But if we take it back a little bit, what made you interested in undertaking graduate research in translational medicine at Queen's in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason why I was really interested in the translational medicine program, so it's called TMed for short, but it's a research-based graduate program where all the students engage in really cool different types of research spanning different fields. Mm. And all of us have kind of like a center point, which is that the research that we engage in has a translational significance. So whatever we do, we hope to make a good impact into the clinical setting to help patients and their future in terms of either understanding how diseases work or quality improvement in the hospital setting, all things like that. So I thought this is something really important, and this is something that I wanted to be part of.
Mm, that sounds very practical and important. So, I mean, basic research is important too, but this type of applied research, I'm sure it's fun to see how you can have an impact immediately in a clinical setting. And is that unique to Queen's? Are there other programs like that across Canada?
I think this is a really unique program. I'm not really sure how many, but there's only a few in Canada, which is a translational medicine specific graduate program. And so it's super cool. Not only did we get to engage in our research, we also had interesting opportunities like observerships where we got to observe physicians and really understand the impact of our research. And we were also able to attend something called medical ground rounds and observe discussions that happen and what kind of cool research goes on in the Queen's community.
Oh, very nice. So that's very exciting. And I'm sure it sounds like very motivating, right, to get to go around the hospital and see directly how research, even if it's not yours immediately, but seeing how other research and new practices are directly influencing patient care at KGH and in the wider community as well. And your research, your master's thesis was titled The Generation of Alternative Transcripts as a Means of Regulating Phosphorylation in Sonic Hedgehog Medulloblastoma. Now, that sounds very complex to me. Can you give a little bit of an overview of your project for maybe someone like myself who doesn't have a background in life sciences or medicine?
Yeah, certainly. So, yeah, it is quite a complex process, many different parts. And so overall, I think as the name suggests, I'm looking at a mechanism that's new, and to see if this is something that actually happens in our body. Is phosphorylation regulated at the level of the transcript? So I want to take a step back and kind walk through what this whole process is and what my research entails. But basically, phosphorylation is a really important process in our body that's important in development and cancer progression.
Okay.
And so this process is controlled by molecules called kinases, where kinases goes into a protein and then adds a phosphate group. And that is a process of phosphorylation.
Okay. Does that happen often? Is that like a unique process or is that common? Like what does that look like?
Yeah, it's actually a really common process. I believe two-thirds of over 20,000 proteins in our human body are phosphorylated. So you can see how significant that is.
Okay, so lots of it's happening all over the place constantly in the human body.
Exactly.
Okay.
And I just want to add, a problem with kinases is that they're known as blunt instruments in that they are reversible and they're able to phosphorylate or target many different proteins and attach these phosphate groups onto them. So then a fundamental question in biology arises, which is that how do you selectively regulate this promiscuous kinase process of phosphorylation? Mm. How do you regulate phosphorylation at the protein level? And then how do you specifically make sure that you're targeting one particular phosphorylation event without overall affecting the others?
Okay, so in cancer development and progression, if you're trying to treat one area, kinases seem to, you might impact way too many of them at once and have other detrimental effects instead of just impacting the one that's related to the cancer development or growth. Is that
correct? Yeah, exactly. Okay. So with this overall effect, we think then, what if the regulation of phosphorylation doesn't actually happen at the protein level? Or maybe it obviously it does, but what if we actually take it a step back and look at regulation of phosphorylation at the transcript level? So
Can you tell me what the transcript level is? Because I'm not too certain about that.
Yeah, so in terms of, I guess, explaining where, you know, transcripts and proteins lie in our body, there's a process called central dogma, mm-hmm. where essentially in our body we go from DNA, which is our genes, our blueprint of information, to RNA, which is the transcript level.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of specific instructions, and then the protein, which is what is essentially made from the specific instructions of the RNA. So, you know, we think of everything at the protein level, but then why don't we take a step back and look at the RNA level? And mRNA in particular, messenger RNA. And then so that is the mechanism that I'm exploring if phosphorylation is regulated in the transcript level. And I looked at two specific processes, which are alternative splicing and alternative transcription start sites, which allow you to generate a wide variety of different transcripts that produce different proteins.
Okay.
So kind of like, think of it as an analogy like I like to do is, let's say there's like a protein, and it's essentially the same protein, but there's different flavors of the protein.
Oh, okay. So it's like mRNA is kind of like giving you a general recipe, and then how that's interpreted in the body results in different proteins. So if you had like a flavor of a base level of cake, and then you had different flavors of cake based on what the mRNA told you to add flavor-wise, is that an okay interpretation?
That's a great analogy. So essentially, alternative transcription start site and alternative splicing, what they essentially do, this is getting really nitty-gritty, but we have something called exons in our body, and that's the part that essentially gets translated into a protein. But these mechanisms, they can either attach or exclude exons in different arrangements, thereby creating this protein diversity.
Mm.
So these are the different combination, aka recipes, I guess, that could translate into a wide range of proteins.
Okay, so you're investigating two mechanisms, alternative transcription sites and alternative splicing, as ways to intervene and change the outcomes of those proteins, correct?
Exactly. Okay. So now you got it. So basically, think of a protein including a phosphorylation site.
Mm-hmm.
So if it includes it, then it's going to get phosphorylated, and we're going to have this effect on, you know, development in cancer. But then what if the recipe or the instructions doesn't contain the phosphorylation site to begin with?
Mm.
Then when it gets made into a protein, it's not going to contain that site of phosphorylation. And maybe this can be a method that is employed by development and cancer to ultimately regulate phosphorylation.
Okay. So where did you test this? Because I remember in your title, there was a thing called sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma. So where does that come into your research project?
Yeah, so sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma is the model we use to study this mechanism. And it's a great model to study because if this mechanism were to happen anywhere, it will be in cancer, which evolves so quickly. And sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma, I'll tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, that would be great. I've never heard of it. I've heard of sonic hedgehog, but never sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma.
Yeah, so medulloblastoma is the most common childhood brain tumor of the cerebellum. And the sonic hedgehog subtype accounts for 30% of all medulloblastoma cases.
Oh, wow. So this is a very common type of pediatric brain cancer then. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the sonic hedgehog subtype, its name is really funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's reliant on a process called sonic hedgehog signaling pathway.
Okay.
And this is a process or signaling pathway that's really important in our body. We all go through it when our brain forms through cerebellar development. But then when it gets dysregulated, this pathway can go crazy. Mm-hmm. And essentially when that happens, through things like mutations, a medulloblastoma ultimately develops.
Okay. And is there a reason for the name in particular?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sonic hedgehog signaling, I think it's based on, I'm not really sure exactly the study that was behind it, mm-hmm. but from my understanding, a group of researchers found that a mutation in flies caused the fly to have a very spiked appearance in their back, kind of like the character Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay, so it's based on that early study and those results. So now, I mean, it's a great way to remember the term, the terminology. So you're looking at signaling in hedgehog medulloblastoma, and then you're looking to see if you can regulate this phosphorylation through going back and before the protein phase in the mRNA stage, or sorry, in the transcription stage. And what did you find when you were testing alternative transcription site and alternative splicing mm-hmm. methods? What did you find when you were doing this?
Yeah, so I compared the cancer model, which mm-hmm. is a medulloblastoma model, to granule neuron precursors, which is the normal kind of tissue model.
Oh.
So essentially, in terms of our normal development, granule neuron precursors, they undergo sonic hedgehog signaling,
mm.
and then this allows these cells to divide and then ultimately turn into something called granule neurons, which are the most abundant cells in our brain.
Okay.
But then if we have, you know, things like mutations happen, it can result in disruptions in the signaling pathway
mm-hmm.
where we undergo rapid proliferation, so rapid division, and uncontrolled growth, ultimately turning into a medulloblastoma tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that these granule neuron precursors and medulloblastoma cells, they act as great comparisons to study my process
mm-hmm.
and figure out exactly what is happening in development and then what is happening in tumor progression. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I had different data sets that were previously generated from my lab.
Okay.
And this includes data sets like phosphoproteomics, which essentially looks at changes in phosphorylation that is happening
mm.
between the development model versus the tumor model. And then I also had an RNA sequencing data set, which looks at the RNA changes, so transcript level changes that are happening between the development and cancer. And then I combined these two data sets, and then I figured out essentially from development to cancer, what is exactly happening,
mm-hmm.
what changes are happening in terms of phosphorylation, and what changes are happening in terms of the transcript, which identifies that these candidates that we're looking for is undergoing either alternative splicing or alternative transcription start sites to ultimately find potential candidates that undergo these mechanisms that we can identify and investigate further.
Okay, so you were looking for ways to find things, that candidates that could do the regulation piece. And did you find any of those, or do you have to keep doing more research after your master's?
Well, yeah, in terms of more research, that is definitely...
Okay, fair enough. Research never ends. Sorry.
Research never ends. But yeah, we found 12 really interesting candidates
wow.
out of a lot of different phosphorylation events. And in particular, I experimentally validated two candidates. They're called RNF220 and CEP9, in which they had high changes in phosphorylation, as well as changes in the transcript level in medulloblastoma compared to the granule neuron precursors.
Okay, so again, for someone who does not have a background in life science, can you tell me what RNF220 and CEP9 are?
Yeah, so RNF220 is a protein, and previous literature shows that it's involved in medulloblastoma progression, and it's also involved in the sonic hedgehog signaling pathway.
Mm.
And it's called a ubiquitin ligase, and
okay.
Essentially it's involved in a process of attaching to proteins and then helping it degrade for kind of like maintenance purposes.
Mm, so it helps the protein degrade so that it, into smaller pieces to be used throughout cells or wherever it's needed in the body, or not quite?
I guess not quite in terms of using it for other purposes. It's more so kind of like a regulation. So let's say we don't want this protein to be expressed, then we can degrade it so that it's no longer there.
Okay, I was wrong. You were very polite, but that was a very polite way to explain it. And what is step 9?
Yeah, step 9 is also really relevant in terms of cancer. There's a lot of research done on breast cancer and step 9, and it's known to be a oncogene in that it actually progresses a tumor.
Okay.
Yeah, step 9, it's involved with the cytoskeleton of our cells, so kind of like the overall structure of the cell. And it's also involved in actin and microfilaments within the cell. So very, very structural, kind of like the structural aspect of our cells. That's what step 9 is involved in.
Okay. So both of those seem to be good candidates for being able to regulate phosphorylation in both the granule neuron precursor regular cells as well as the sonic hedgehog medulloblastoma?
Yeah, we definitely do think that. So this high level of phosphorylation that's prevalent in medulloblastoma compared to granule neuron precursors, we think that this phosphorylation, you know, is actually helping this tumor do its thing in that, you know, either, you know, helps with its invasion properties, perhaps its motility. That's what we think of in terms of step 9. But then RNF220, we think that maybe phosphorylation can be important in terms of this helping stabilize the RNF220 interaction with other proteins for it to have its function.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does. So your research sounds very promising, right? You've identified some, well, you said 12, but these two really specific ones that you validated. So can you tell us about the potential impact or the significance of your research? Like, where do you think these findings could go in the future, either yourself or with other researchers from the scholarly community taking your work and moving forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the first is how, if we explore, which is what we're currently doing, the functional consequences of what these, what RNF220 and step 9 does. So in terms of overexpressing this this gene, what happens, or knocking down this gene, what happens in the medulloblastoma cells, and then figuring out exactly what they're involved in and what their roles are in terms of tumor progression, that's really important.
Okay, yeah.
And another thing that's important in terms of my research is the methodology that I use to identify these candidates. Things that are going through phosphorylation, they must be functionally relevant. So through this method of integrating phosphoproteomics data and RNA sequencing data, and then using a method to figure out what exactly is happening in the development and tumor model, we can ultimately find potential candidates in other situations. And this can be a method used by other scientists to figure out what targets are out there and what exactly is relevant in terms of pinpointing and identifying and then further researching.
Oh, that's exciting. So it sounds like you're making two novel contributions, both in the specific identification of candidates as well as methodologically. You've created a bit of a pathway for others to do kind of the same type of exploration, but using different tumor models or different models altogether. So that's really exciting that there's two really distinct contributions that you've got from your master's research.
I also just want to note that, alternate transcripts as a means of regulating phosphorylation, this hasn't been systematically investigated before at the phosphoproteomics level, to my understanding. So this is quite novel in that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Taking it a step back to figure out what is being used to regulate phosphorylation, I think that's really important.
Oh, very cool. So you've got some very, very cutting edge kind of contributions. I don't know, which is super exciting. And where does this research fit into with what other people are doing in your lab currently? Like, are you all working on these cutting edge methods? Like, how did you come up with such an interesting project that makes all these different contributions?
So I'm part of a brain tumor lab, and we study two types of brain tumors. So the pediatric brain tumor, which is the medulloblastoma, and then the brain tumor that's prevalent in adults, which is the glioblastoma.
Okay.
And then we investigate how, we investigate a lot on what this tumor looks like and essentially how we can stop this tumor from developing and progressing and ultimately finding different therapeutics and targets for treatments.
Oh, well, that sounds like a really important place to be. Mm-hmm. And this sounds like you've kept very busy throughout your master's, right? You've done a lot of work and in a very busy lab, it sounds like, as well, with lots of other research going on. But I've also heard that you have stayed quite involved during your time at Queen's outside of the lab. What are some organizations or programs that you've been involved with on campus during your master's?
Yeah, so I have a passion for student governance. Mm. And I think I really like the aspect of community engagement and really building within the bonds that you can create with your fellow students. And so I was involved in my student council in the graduate program, and I was the IEDIA representative. So I created different initiatives to promote principles of equity, inclusion, diversity, accessibility.
Oh, very nice. That's so important to have students involved in making your experience what you want it to be in your department, right? So
yeah, it was a really interesting experience, and I think a highlight was when I worked closely with the student council and we created the first ever in person because of COVID,
of course, yeah,
health sciences symposium at Queen's.
Oh,
focused
cool.
On research that goes on related to these IEDIA principles.
Oh, that's really exciting, because I mean, you're doing research promotion right now, sharing your work, but it's so nice to hear that you and your student council kind of collaborators were able to create a space for other students to share their research and showcase all the really amazing work that people are doing in mm-hmm. the life sciences.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really important to highlight how, even as early researchers, mm-hmm. how we could integrate principles and make sure that what we're doing is, you know, equitable, we're including. And this can, in terms of even basic science, this mm-hmm. can even be making sure that we're including, you know, different if you're working with different populations, mm-hmm. making sure that that's reflected, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. understanding sex differences exist in your research as well. Those principles, not overlooking those.
Yeah, no, it carries through in kind of both the work that you do, but also how you do the work. It's important to consider EDI principles and values across both the topics and the applications, I guess, of the research as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some other things that you've got up to on campus?
Yeah, I was also part of the Board of Trustees as the graduate student trustee. And the Board of Trustees, it's one of the three main governing bodies of Queen's University. And we oversee things related to the structure, finance of the university.
That sounds like a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, we made a lot of big decisions, including the budget.
Mm-hmm.
You know, approving what kind of buildings get renovated, tuition fees, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, so I mean, that is a lot of important work. And what type of commitment was that?
Yeah, Board of Trustees was a volunteer role, and we meet 4 times a year.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about what that meeting looks like?
So basically, this is a 2-day process.
Wow. Okay. So not your regular meetings.
Yeah. And then we have different committees that mm-hmm. meet first, gather and vote on certain committee-related topics. And then ultimately, we come together at the end to talk about what the committee talked about and also vote on things that are, you know, essential to everybody being involved. And
like
so
pan-university issues you vote on.
Yeah,
and, okay, yeah.
Exactly. And so I was part of the UCC committee, also known as the University Culture Committee.
Okay. And what does the UCC committee take care of?
So the University Culture Committee, we look at Queen's University in terms of workplace culture as well as student experience. And then we talk about, you know, what the current students are feeling, what's the current climate like in terms of Queen's. And then we also approve policies like the harassment and discrimination prevention and response policy.
Oh, okay. So then you bring those forward and then the university then works to implement those to make sure that we have a good working culture and a good student experience for everyone
exactly.
who's a part of Queen's. Okay, yeah. So that sounds very interesting, because it sounds like you had to work with a really large group of people making up the Board of Trustees. Is there, you mentioned there were students. Were you the only student on the board? Are there other folks that join you? Or
So there's three students on the Board of Trustees. So myself, which is the graduate student representative, as well as the undergraduate student representative, and then the rector, which is the representative of all students.
Oh, okay. And working in committees, especially as one of only three students, it sounds like it could be intimidating or challenging, but what are some things you learned about working with a big group of people in a committee setting where you may be one of the more junior folks in the room? What did you learn from that?
I think, first of all, it was quite intimidating at first, especially as a lot of people come from different backgrounds. Mm. You know, a lot of people with financial expertise, people that have really big titles in their names. But ultimately what helped was first, you know, understanding what this role entails, which is that you are here to represent the graduate students, meaning that you're going to have these difficult conversations as the person in the room that has a voice to speak up and talk to these key decision makers. And so putting that mindset really helped me navigate these intimidating situations, really honing into what this role does. And also what helped was collaboration. Mm-hmm. So I worked closely with both the undergraduate student trustee as well as the rector. And we, before the board meetings, we prepared by figuring out, okay, what's kind of like the main topics we want the board to understand and know about, and how can we integrate it into the agenda items that are being discussed in these meetings, and ultimately be able to effectively communicate what is going on and what is needed. And I just want to say everybody in the Board of Trustees are super duper nice. Mm-hmm. So although at first there was this... it was intimidating at first. No, everybody was super nice, and that allowed me to be comfortable and being able to effectively communicate.
Oh, I'm glad. Well, it's good to know that graduate students have strong representation through yourself, and that our undergraduate students and the whole student body are represented by the undergraduate student rep and the rector. And it's, I think, really nice to see students like yourself taking on such a big volunteer responsibility and taking it so seriously to really effectively represent the wide variety of student voices on campus. So thank you for all of that time and effort that you put into that role, because it's essential to make sure that graduate student voices are heard.
Thank you so much.
Well, Kanna, it has been lovely chatting with you. Thank you so much for doing the show and sharing all of the interesting findings you found in your master's research, and for telling us all about some of your student governance experience on the TMED Student Council and on the Board of Trustees. And best luck with your next steps, and hopefully we will hear all about your work, how it's being carried forward in the rest of your lab. So that is it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.